Jack, the first rule of war is the mission. First, why the hell are you out there, and then what are you proposing to do about it? The rights of man makes a pretty good starting point, doesn't it? By the way, CNN's going to be at Pabst Church tomorrow and at Jerry Patterson's. They're switching off, preaching in each other's pulpit for the memorial ceremonies, and CNN decided to cover it as a news event in and of itself. Good call, I think, Jackson editorialized. Wasn't like that in Mississippi back when I was a boy. It's going to be like you said. I'm only guessing, Robbie admitted, but I don't see either one of them playing it cool. It's too good an opportunity to teach a good lesson about how the Lord doesn't care a rat's ass what color we are, and how all men of faith should stand together. They'll both probably fold in the abortion thing. Pap ain't real keen on abortion rights, and neither's Patterson. But mainly it'll be about justice and equality and how two good men went to see God after doing the right thing. Your dad's pretty good with a sermon, eh? If they gave out Pulitzers for preaching, he'd have a wall covered in the things, Jack, and Jerry Patterson ain't too bad for a white boy either. Ah, Yefremov observed. He was in the building perch instead of one of the vehicles. It was more comfortable, and he was senior enough to deserve and appreciate the comforts. There was Suvorov, slash Konyev, sitting back on the bench, an afternoon newspaper in his hands. They didn't have to watch, but watch they did, just to be sure. Of course, there were thousands of park benches in Moscow, and the probability that their subject would sit in the same one this many times was genuinely astronomical. That's what they would argue to the judge when the time came for the trial, depending on what was in the subject's right hand. His KGB file said that he was right-handed, and it seemed to be the case. He was so skillful that you could hardly see what he did, but it was done, and it was seen. His right hand left the paper, reached inside his jacket, and pulled out something metallic. Then the hand paused briefly, and as he turned pages in the paper, the fluttering of the paper was a fine distraction to anyone who might be watching, since the human eye is always drawn to movement. The right hand slid down and affixed the metal transfer case to the magnetic holder, then returned for the paper, all in one smooth motion, done so quickly as to be invisible. Well, almost, Yefremov thought. He'd caught spies before. Four of them, in fact, which explained his promotion to a supervisory position. And every one had a thrill attached to it, because he was chasing and catching the most elusive of game. And this one was Russian-trained, the most elusive of all. He'd never bagged one of them before, and there was the extra thrill of catching not just a spy, but a traitor as well. And perhaps a traitor guilty of murder, he wondered. That was another first. Never in his experience had espionage involved the violation of that law. No, an intelligence operation was about the transfer of information, which was dangerous enough. The inclusion of murder was an additional hazard that was not calculated to please a trained spy. It made noise, as they said, and noise was something a spy avoided as much as a cat burglar, and for much the same reason. "Call Provolov," Yefremov told his subordinate. Two reasons for that. First, he rather owed it to the militia lieutenant, who'd presented him with both the case and the subject. Second, the civilian cop might know something useful to his part of this case. They continued to watch Suvorov slash Konyev for another 10 minutes. Finally, he stood and walked back to his car for the drive back to his apartment, during which he was duly followed by the ever-changing surveillance team. After the requisite 15 minutes, one of Yefremov's people crossed the street and retrieved the case from the bench. It was the locked one again, which told them that the item inside was perhaps more important. You had to get past the anti-tamper device to keep the contents from being destroyed. But the FSS had people well skilled in that, and the key for this transfer case had already been struck. That was confirmed 20 minutes later, When the case was opened and the contents extracted, unfolded, photographed, refolded, reinserted, and finally relocked in the container, which was immediately driven back to the bench. Back at FSS headquarters, the decryption team typed the message into a computer into which the one-time pad had already been inputted. After that, it was a matter of mere seconds before the computer performed a function not unlike sliding a document over a printed template. The clear text message was agreeably in Russian. The content of the message was something else.
"Yob tvoyu mat," the technician breathed, in one of his language's more repulsive imprecations. "Fuck your mother."
Then he handed the page to one of the supervising inspectors, whose reaction was little different. Then he walked to the phone and dialed Yefremov's number.
"Pavel Georgievich, you need to see this."
Provolov was there when the chief of the decryption section walked in. The printout was in a manila folder, which the head crippy handed over without a word.
"Well, Pasha?" the homicide investigator asked. "Well, we have answered our first question."
"The motor car was even purchased at the same dealership in central Moscow," the sheet read. "There is no fault to be found here. The men who performed the mission are both dead in St. P. Before I can make another attempt, I need an indication from you on the timeline, and also on the payment to my contractors."
"Golovko was the target, then," Provolov observed.
"And the head of our country's intelligence service owes his life to a pimp."
"So it would appear," Yefremov agreed.
"Note that he doesn't ask payment for himself. I would imagine he's somewhat embarrassed at having missed his target on the first attempt."
"But he's working for the Chinese?"
"So that would appear as well," the FSS man observed, with an inward chill. "Why," he asked himself, "would the Chinese wish to do such a thing? Isn't that nearly an act of war?" He sat back in his chair and lit up a smoke, looking into the eyes of his police colleague. Neither man knew what to say at the moment, and both kept silent. It would all soon be out of and far beyond their hands. With that decided, both men headed home for dinner. The morning broke more brightly than usual in Beijing. Mrs. Yu had slept deeply and well, and though she awoke with a slight headache, she was grateful for Wen's insistence on a couple of drinks before retiring. Then she remembered why she was in Beijing, and any good feelings departed from her mind. Breakfast was mainly green tea and was spent looking down, remembering the sound of her husband's voice in the bleak acceptance of the fact that she'd never hear it again. He'd always been in a good mood over breakfast, never forgetting, as she had just done, to say grace over the morning meal and thank God for another day in which to serve him. No more. No more would he do that, she reminded herself. But she had duties of her own to perform.
"What can we do, Zhang?" she asked, when her host appeared.
"I will go with you to the police post and we will ask for Fa'an's body, and then I will help you fly our friend home, and we will have a memorial prayer service at the—"
"No, you can't, Zhang. There are police there to keep everyone out. They wouldn't even let me in, even though I had my papers in order."
"Then we will have it outside, and they will watch us pray for our friend," the restaurateur told his guest with gentle resolve.
10 minutes later she'd cleaned up and was ready to leave. The police station was only 4 blocks away, a simple building, ordinary in all respects except for the sign over the door. "Yes?" the desk officer said when his peripheral vision noted the presence of people by his desk. He looked up from the paper forms that had occupied his attention for the past few minutes to see a woman and a man of about the same age.
"I am Yu Chun," Mrs. Yu answered,
seeing some recognition in the desk officer's eyes result from her words. "You are the wife of Yu Fa'an?" he asked. "That is correct." "Your husband was an enemy of the people," the cop said next. "Sure of that, but not sure of much else in this awkward case." "I believe he was not. But all I ask is for his body, so that I might fly it home for burial with his family."
"I do not know where his body is," the cop said.
"But he was shot by a policeman," Wen put in, "and the disposal of his body is therefore a police matter. So might you be so kind, comrade, as to call the proper number so that we can remove our friend's body?" His manners did not allow anger on the part of the desk officer. But the desk cop really didn't know what number to call, and so he called someone inside the building, in the large administration division. He found this embarrassing to do with two citizens standing by his desk, but there was no avoiding that. "Yes," a voice answered on his third internal call. "This is Sergeant Zhang at the desk in the public lobby. I have Yu Chun here, seeking the body of her husband, Yu Fa'an. I need to tell her where to go." The reply took a few seconds for the man on the other end of the phone, who had to remember. "Ah, yes. Tell her she can go to the Da Yunhe River. His body was cremated and the ashes dumped in the water last evening. And, enemy of the people or not, it would not be a pleasant thing to tell his widow, who'd probably had feelings for him." Sergeant Jiang set the phone down and decided to give her the news. "The body of Yu Fa'an was cremated and the ashes scattered in the river, comrade." "That is cruel," Wen said at once. Chun was too stunned to say anything at the moment. "I cannot help you more than that," Zhang told his visitors, and looked back down at his paperwork to dismiss them. "Where is my husband?" Yu Chun managed to blurt, after 30 seconds or so of silence. "Your husband's body was cremated and the ashes scattered," Zhang said, without looking up, because he really didn't wish to see her eyes under these circumstances. "I cannot help you further. You may leave now."
"I want my husband back," she insisted.
"Your husband is dead and his body has been cremated." "Begone now," Sergeant Zhang insisted in return, wishing she'd just go away and allow him to get back to his paperwork.
"I want my husband,"
she said louder now, causing a few eyes to turn her way in the lobby. "He is gone, Chun," Wen Zhang told her, taking her arm and steering her to the door. "Come, we will pray for him outside."
"But why did they? I mean, why is he? And why did they?"
It had just been too much for 1 24-hour period. Despite the night's sleep, Yu Chun was still too disoriented. Her husband of over 20 years had vanished, and now she could not even see the urn containing his ashes. It was a lot to absorb for a woman who'd never so much as bumped into a policeman on the street, who'd never done a single thing to offend the state, except, perhaps, to marry a Christian. But what did that hurt, anyway? Had either of them, had any of their congregation, ever plotted treason against the state? No. Had any of them so much as violated the criminal or civil law? No. And so why had this misfortune fallen upon her? She felt as though she'd been struck by an invisible truck while crossing the street. Then had it decided that her injuries were all her fault. Behind one invisible truck was just another, and all the more merciless at that. There was nothing left for her to do, no recourse, legal or otherwise. They couldn't even go into her home, whose living room had so often served as their church, there to pray for Yu's soul and entreat God for mercy and help. Instead, they'd pray. Where? She wondered. One thing at a time. She and Wen walked outside, escaping the eyes of the lobby, which had zoomed in on them with almost physical impact. The eyes and the weight they'd carried were soon left behind. But the sun outside was just one more thing that intruded on what ought to have been, and what needed to be, a day of peace and lonely prayer to a God whose mercy was not very evident at the moment. Instead, the brightness of the sun defeated her eyelids, bringing unwanted brilliance into the darkness that might have simulated, if not exactly granted, peace. She had a flight booked back to Hong Kong, and from there back to Taipei, where she could at least weep in the presence of her mother, who was awaiting her death as well, for the woman was over 90 and frail. For Barry Wise, the day had long since begun. His colleagues in Atlanta had praised him to the heavens in an email about his earlier story. "Maybe another Emmy," they said. Wise liked getting the awards, but they weren't the reason for his work. It was just what he did. He wouldn't even say he enjoyed it, because the news he reported was rarely pretty or pleasant. It was just his job, the work he'd chosen to do. If there was an aspect of it that he actually liked, it was the newness of it. Just as people awoke wondering what they'd see on CNN every day, from baseball scores to executions, so he awoke every day wondering what he'd report. He often had some idea of where the story would be and roughly what it would contain, but you were never really sure, and in the newness was the adventure of his job. He'd learned to trust his instincts, though he never really understood where they came from or how they seemed to know what they did. And today his instincts reminded him that one of the people he'd seen shot the other day had said he was married, and that his wife was on Taiwan. Maybe she'd be back now. It was worth trying out. He tried to get Atlanta to check with the Vatican, but that story would be handled by the Rome Bureau. The aircraft containing Cardinal DiMillo's body was on its way back to Italy, where somebody would be making a big deal about it for CNN to cover live and on tape to show to the entire world 10 times at least. The hotel room had a coffee maker, and he brewed his own from beans stolen from the CNN Beijing bureau office. Sipping coffee for him, as for so many others, helped him think. Okay, he thought. The Italian guy, the cardinal, his body was gone, boxed and shipped out on an Alitalia 747, probably somewhere over Afghanistan right now. But what about the Chinese guy, the Baptist minister who took the round in the head? He had to have left a body behind, too. And he had a congregation, and he said he was married, didn't he? Okay, if so, he had a wife somewhere, and she'd want the body back to Barry. So, at the least, he could try to interview her. It would be a good follow-up, and would allow Atlanta to play the tape of the killings again. He was sure the Beijing government had written him onto their official shit list, but fuck 'em, Wise thought with a sip of the Starbucks. It was hardly a disgrace to be there, was it? These people were racist as hell. Even folks on the street cringed to see him pass, with his dark skin. Even Birmingham under Bull Connor hadn't treated black Americans like aliens from another goddamn planet. Here everyone looked the same, dressed the same, talked the same. Hell, they needed some black people just to liven up the mix some. Toss in a few blonde Swedes and maybe a few Italians to set up a decent restaurant. But it wasn't his job to civilize the world, just to tell people what was going on in it. The trade folks were not where it was happening, not today, Wise thought. Today he and his satellite truck would head back to the home of Reverend Yu Fa An. Wise was playing a hunch. No more than that. But they'd rarely failed him before. Ryan was enjoying another night off. The following night would be different. He had to give another goddamn speech on foreign policy. Why he couldn't simply announce policy in the press room and be done with it, nobody had yet told him. And he hadn't asked, for fear of looking the fool again before Arnie. This was just how it was done. The speech and the subject had nothing to do with the identity of the group he was addressing. Surely there had to be an easier way to tell the world what he thought. This way, too, Kathy had to come with him, and she hated these things even more than he did, because it took her away from her patient notes, which she guarded about as forcefully as a lion over the wildebeests he'd just killed for lunch. Kathy often complained that this first lady stuff was hurting her performance as a surgeon. Jack didn't believe that. It was more likely that, like most women, Kathy needed something to bitch about. And this subject was worthier than her more pedestrian complaints, like being unable to cook dinner once in a while, which she missed a lot more than the women's lib people would have cared to learn. Kathy had spent over 20 years learning to be a gourmet cook, and when time allowed, rarely, she'd sneak down to the capacious White House kitchen to trade ideas and recipes with the head chef. For the moment, however, she was curled up in a comfortable chair making notes on her patient files and sipping at her wine glass, while Jack watched TV. For a change not under the eyes of the Secret Service detail and the domestic staff. But the President wasn't really watching TV. His eyes were pointed in that direction, but his mind was looking at something else. It was a look his wife had learned to understand in the past year, almost like open-eyed sleep while his brain churned over a problem. In fact, it was something she did herself often enough, thinking about the best way to treat a patient's problem while eating lunch at the Hopkins doctor's cafeteria, her brain creating a picture as though in a Disney cartoon, simulating the problem and then trying out theoretical fixes. It didn't happen all that much anymore. The laser applications she'd helped to develop were approaching the point that an auto mechanic could perform them, which was not something she or her colleagues advertised, of course. There had to be a mystique with medicine, or else you lost your power to tell your patients what to do in a way that ensured that they might actually do it. For some reason, that didn't translate to the presidency, Kathy thought. With Congress, well, most of the time they went along with him. As well they ought, since Jack's requests were usually as reasonable as they could be. But not always, and often for the dumbest reasons. It may be good for the country, but it's not so good for my district, and they all forgot the fact that when they had arrived in Washington, they'd sworn an oath to the country, not to their stupid little districts. When she'd said that to Arnie, he'd had a good laugh and lectured her on how the real world worked. As though a physician didn't know that, she fumed. And so Jack had to balance what was real with what wasn't, but ought to be, as opposed to what wasn't and never would be. Like foreign affairs. It made a lot more sense for a married man to have an affair with some floozy than it did to try to reason with some foreign countries. At least you could tell the floozy that it was all over after 3 or 4 times. But these damned foreign chiefs of state would stay around forever with their stupidity. That was one nice thing about medicine, Professor Ryan thought. Doctors all over the world treated patients pretty much the same way because the human body was the same everywhere. And a treatment regimen that worked at Johns Hopkins in East Baltimore worked just as well in Berlin or Moscow or Tokyo, even if the people looked and talked different. And if that was true, why couldn't people all over the world think the same way? Their damned brains were the same, weren't they? Now it was her turn to grumble, as her husband did often enough. Jack, she said, as she put her notebook down. Yeah, Kathy? What are you thinking about now? Mainly how I wish Ellen Sumter was here with a cigarette, he couldn't say. If Kathy knew he was sneaking smokes in the Oval Office, she didn't let on, which was probably the case, since she didn't go around looking for things to fight over, and he never ever smoked in front of her or the kids anymore. Kathy allowed him to indulge his weaknesses as long as he did so in the utmost moderation. But her question was about the cause for his yearning for some nicotine. China, babe. They really stepped on the old crank with the golf shoes this time. But they don't seem to know how bad it looked.
Killing those 2 people? How could it not look bad? Surgeon asked.
Not everybody values human life in the same way that we do, Kath.
The Chinese doctors I've met are, well, they're doctors, and we talk to each other like doctors.
I suppose. Ryan saw a commercial start on the TV show he was pretending to watch, and stood to walk off to the upstairs kitchen for another whiskey. Refill, babe?
Yes, thank you.
With her Christmas tree smile. Jack lifted his wife's wine glass. So she had no procedure scheduled for the next day. She'd come to love the Chateau Saint-Michel Chardonnay they'd first sampled at Camp David. For him tonight it was wild turkey bourbon over ice. He loved the pungent smell of the corn and rye grains, and tonight he dismissed the upstairs staff and could enjoy the relative luxury of fixing his own. He could even have made a peanut butter sandwich, had he been of such a mind. He walked the drinks back, touching his wife's neck on the way, and getting the cute little shiver she always made when he did so.
So, what's going to happen in China?
We'll find out the same way as everybody else, watching CNN. They're a lot faster than our intelligence people on some things, and our spooks can't predict the future any better than the traders on Wall Street.
You'd be able to identify such a man at Merrill Lynch easily if he existed, Jack didn't bother saying aloud.
He'd be the guy with all the millionaires lined up outside his office.
So, what do you think?
I'm worried, Kath, Ryan admitted, sitting back down.
About what?
About what we'll have to do if they screw things up again. But we can't warn them. That only makes it certain that bad things are going to happen, because then they'll do something really dumb just to show us how powerful they are. That's how nation-states are. You can't talk to them like real people. The people who make the decisions over there think with their...
dicks? Kathy offered with a half-giggle.
Yep, Jack confirmed with a nod. A lot of them follow their dicks everywhere they go, too. We know about some foreign leaders who have habits that would get them tossed out of any decent whorehouse in the world. They just love to show everybody how tough and manly they are. And to do that, they act like animals in a goddamn barnyard.
Secretaries?
A lot of that, Ryan nodded. Hell, Chairman Mao liked doing 12-year-old virgins, like changing shirts. I guess old as he was, it was the best he could do.
No Viagra back then, Jack, Kathy pointed out.
Well, you suppose that drug will help civilize the world, he asked, turning to grin at his physician wife. It didn't seem a likely prospect.
Well, maybe it'll protect a lot of 12-year-olds.
Jack checked his watch. Another half hour and he'd be turning in. Until then, maybe he could actually watch the TV for a little while. Rutledge was just waking up. Under his door was an envelope, which he picked up and opened, to find an official communique from Foggy Bottom, his instructions for the day, which weren't terribly different from those of the previous day. Nothing in the way of concessions to offer, which were the grease of dealing with the PRC. You had to give them something if you wanted to get anything, and the Chinese never seemed to realize that such a procedure could and occasionally should work the other way as well. Rutledge headed to his private bathroom and wondered if it had been like this chatting with German diplomats in May 1939. Could anyone have prevented that war from breaking out, he wondered? Probably not, in retrospect. Some chiefs of state were just too damn stupid to grasp what their diplomats told them. Or maybe the idea of war just appealed to one sort of mind. Well, even diplomacy had its limitations, didn't it? Breakfast was served half an hour later, by which time Rutledge was showered and shaved pink. His staff were all there in the dining room, looking over the papers for the most part, learning what was going on back home. They already knew, or thought they knew, what was going to happen here. A whole lot of nothing. Rutledge agreed with that assessment. He was wrong, too. Chapter 30 And the Rights of Men. Got the address? Wise asked his driver. He was also the team's cameraman,
and drew the driving duty because of his steady hands and genius for anticipating traffic clogs.
"Got it, Barry," the man assured him. Better yet, it had been inputted into the satellite navigation system, and the computer would tell them how to get there. Hertz was going to conquer the world someday, Wise reflected with a chuckle. Just so they didn't bring back the O.J. commercials.
"Going to rain, looks like," Barry Wise thought.
"Could be," his producer agreed.
"What do you suppose happened to the gal who had the baby?" the cameraman asked from the driver's seat.
"Probably home with her kid now. I bet they don't keep mothers in the hospital very long here," Wise speculated.
"Trouble is, we don't know her address. No way to do a follow-up on her and the kid."
And that was too bad, Wise could have added.
They had the surname, Young, on their original tape, but the given names of the husband and wife were both garbled.
"Yeah, I bet there's a lot of Yangs in the phone book here."
"Probably," Wise agreed.
He didn't even know if there was such a thing as a Beijing phone book, or if the Yang family had a phone, and none of his crew could read the ideographic characters that constituted the Chinese written language. All of those factors combined to make a stone wall.
"Two blocks," the cameraman reported from the front seat.
"Just have to turn left. Here."
The first thing they saw was a crowd of khaki uniforms, the local police, standing there like soldiers on guard duty, which was essentially what they were, of course. They parked the van and hopped out, and were immediately scrutinized as though they were alighting from an alien spacecraft. Pete Nichols had his camera out and up on his shoulder, and that didn't make the local cops any happier, because they'd all been briefed on this CNN crew at the Long Fu Hospital and what they'd done to damage the People's Republic. So the looks they gave the TV crew were poisonous. Wise and his crew could not have asked for anything better for their purposes. Wise just walked up to the cop with the most rank stuff on his uniform.
"Good day," Barry said pleasantly.
The sergeant in command of the group just nodded. His face was entirely neutral, as though he were playing cards for modest stakes.
"Could you help us?" Wise asked.
"Help you do what?" the cop asked in his broken English, suddenly angry at himself for admitting he could speak the language.
Better if he'd played dumb, he realized a few seconds too late.
"We are looking for Mrs. Yu, the wife of the Reverend Yu, who used to live here."
"No here," the police sergeant replied with a wave of the hands.
"No here."
"Then we will wait," Wise told him.
"Minister," Cliff Rutledge said in greeting. Shen was late, which was a surprise to the American delegation. It could have meant that he was delivering a message to his guests, telling them that they were not terribly important in the great scheme of things. Or he might have been delayed by new instructions from the Politburo. Or maybe his car hadn't wanted to start this morning. Personally, Rutledge leaned toward option number 2. The Politburo would want to have input into these talks. Shentang had probably been a moderating influence, explaining to his colleagues that the American position, however unjust, would be difficult to shake in this series of talks. And so the smart long-term move would be to accommodate the American position for now, and make up for the losses in the next go-around the following year. The American sense of fair play, he would have told them, had cost them more negotiations than any other single factor in history, after all. That's what Rutledge would have done in his place, and he knew Shen was no fool. In fact, he was a competent diplomatic technician, and pretty good at reading the situation quickly. He had to know. No, Rutledge corrected himself. He should know, or ought to know, that the American position was being driven by public opinion at home, and that that public opinion was against the interests of the PRC, because the PRC had fucked up in public. So if he'd been able to sell his position to the rest of the Politburo, he'd start off with a small concession, one which would show the course the day would take, allowing Rutledge to beat him back a few steps by the close of the afternoon session. Rutledge hoped for that, because it would get him what his country wanted with little further fuss, and would, by the way, make him look pretty good at Foggy Bottom. So he took a final sip of the welcoming tea and settled back in his chair, motioning for Shen to begin the morning's talks. "We find it difficult to understand America's position in this and other matters."
Uh-oh.
"America has chosen to affront our sovereignty in many ways. First, the Taiwan issue." Rutledge listened to the earphone, which gave him the simultaneous translation. So Shen hadn't been able to persuade the Politburo to take a reasonable tack. That meant another unproductive day at these talks, and maybe, possible but not likely as yet, failed talks entirely. If America was unable to get concessions from China, and was therefore forced to impose sanctions, it would be ruinous to both sides, and not calculated to make the world a safer or better place. The tirade lasted 27 minutes by his watch. "Minister," Rutledge began when it was his turn, "I find it difficult as well to understand your intransigence." He went on along his own well-grooved path, varying only slightly, when he said, "We put you on notice that unless the PRC allows its markets to be opened to American trade goods, the government of the United States will enact the provisions of the Trade Reform Act." Rutledge saw Shen's face coloring up some. Why? He had to know the rules of the new game. Rutledge had said this 50 times in the previous few days.
Okay, fine. He'd never said, "put on notice," which was diplo-speak for, "no shit, Charlie, we're not fucking kidding anymore." But the import of his earlier statements had been straightforward enough, and Shen was no fool. Was he? Or had Cliff Rutledge misread this whole session?
"Hello," a female voice said. Wise's head turned sharply. "Hi. Have we met?" "You met my husband briefly. I am Yu Chun," the woman said, as Barry Wise came to his feet. Her English was pretty good, probably from watching a lot of TV, which was teaching English, the American version anyway, to the entire world. "Oh." Wise blinked a few times. "Mrs. Yu, please accept our condolences for the loss of your husband. He was a very courageous man." Her head nodded at the good wishes, but they made her choke up a little, remembering what sort of man Fa An had been. "Thank you," she managed to say, struggling not to show the emotions that welled up within her, held back, however, as though by a sturdy dam. "Is there going to be a memorial service for your husband? If so, ma'am, we would ask your permission to make a record of it." Wise had never grown to like the, "oh, your loved one is dead, what's it feel like?" school of journalism. He'd seen far more death as a reporter than as a Marine, and it was all the same all over the world. The guy on the pale horse came to visit, always taking away something precious to somebody. Most of the time more than one somebody, and the vacuum of feelings it left behind could only be filled by tears, and that language was universal. The good news was that people all over the world understood. The bad news was that getting it out did further harm to the living victims, and Wise had trouble stomaching his occasional obligation to do that, however relevant it was to the all-important story.
"I do not know. We used to worship there in our house, but the police will not let me inside," she told him.
"Can I help?" Wise offered, truly meaning it. "Sometimes the police will listen to people like us." He gestured to them, all of 20 meters away, quietly to Pete Nichols. "Saddle up." How it looked to the cops was hard for the Americans to imagine. But the Widow Yu walked toward them with this American black man in attendance and the white one with the camera close behind. She started talking to the senior cop, with Wise's microphone between the two of them, speaking calmly and politely, asking permission to enter her home. The police sergeant shook his head in the universal, "No, you cannot," gesture that needed no translation. "Wait a minute. Mrs. Yu, could you please translate for me?" She nodded. "Sergeant, you know who I am, and you know what I do, correct?" This generated a curt and none too friendly nod. "What is the reason for not allowing this lady to enter her own home?" "I have my orders," Chun translated the reply. "I see," Wise responded. "Do you know that this will look bad for your country? People around the world will see this and feel it is improper." Yu Chun duly translated this for the sergeant. "I have my orders," he said again through her, and it was plain that further discussion with a statue would have been equally productive. "Perhaps if you called your superior," Wise suggested. And to his surprise, the Chinese cop leaped on it, lifting his portable radio and calling his station. "My lieutenant come," Yu Chun translated. The sergeant was clearly relieved, now able to dump the situation on someone else, who answered directly to the captain at the station. "Good, let's go back to the truck and wait for him," Wise suggested. Once there, Mrs. Yu lit up an unfiltered Chinese cigarette and tried to retain her composure. Nichols let the camera down and everyone relaxed for a few minutes. "How long were you married, ma'am?" Wise asked, with the camera shut off.
24 years, she answered.
"Children?"
"One son. He is away at school in America, University of Oklahoma. He study engineering," Chun told the American crew.
"Pete," Wise said quietly, "get the dish up and operating." "Right." The cameraman ducked his head to go inside the van. There he switched on the uplink systems. Atop the van, the mini-dish turned 50 degrees in the horizontal and 60 degrees in the vertical, and saw the communication satellite they usually used in Beijing. When he had the signal on his indicator, he selected Channel 6 again and used it to inform Atlanta that he was initiating a live feed from Beijing. With that, a home office producer started monitoring the feed, and saw nothing. He might have succumbed to immediate boredom, but he knew Barry Wise was usually good for something, and didn't go live unless there was a good reason for it. So he leaned back in his comfortable swivel chair and sipped at his coffee, then notified the duty director in master control that there was a live signal inbound from Beijing, type and scope of story unknown. But the director, too, knew that Wise and his crew had sent in a possible Emmy-class story just 2 days earlier. And to the best of anyone's knowledge, none of the majors was doing anything at all in Beijing at the moment. CNN tracked the communication satellite traffic as assiduously as the National Security Agency to see what the competition was doing. More people started showing up at the Wen house/church. Some were startled to see the CNN truck, but when they saw Yu Chun there, they relaxed somewhat, trusting her to know what was happening. Showing up in ones and twos for the most part, there were soon 30 or so people, most of them holding what had to be Bibles, Wise thought, getting Nichols up and operating again, but this time with a live signal going up and down to Atlanta. "This is Barry Wise in Beijing. We are outside the home of the Reverend Yu Fa'an, the Baptist minister who died just 2 days ago along with Renato Cardinal D'Amelio, the papal nuncio, or Vatican ambassador to the People's Republic. With me now is his widow, Yu Chun. She and the Reverend were married for 24 years, and they have a son now studying at the University of Oklahoma at Norman. As you can imagine, this is not a pleasant time for Mrs. Yu, but it is all the more unpleasant since the local police will not allow her to enter her own home."